From ACB Radio Mainstream, welcome to Tuesday Topics. For the next hour, we will be discussing a topic of interest to blind and visually impaired people. And now, from Miami, Florida, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Good evening. I am Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and this is Tuesday Topics. I generally begin by thanking my producer, Brian Charlson, and my erstwhile recorder editor, Steve Bauer, who really ought to have his name perhaps at the top of this show. Steve does an immensely good job in terms of making sure the Tuesday Topics actually makes it onto the air. I would also, of course, like to thank everyone who is here this evening, and as well would want to express our appreciation to George Buys and to Talking Communities for making this software available that allows Tuesday Topics to happen. So Talking Communities, thank you so much, George. We appreciate all that you do. Tonight we're exploring a topic which may seem on the face of it a somewhat boring and not very exciting subject, but it is one that's extremely important for people who are blind, and more than that, it is one that I think is fascinating in terms of where we as a community may be able to help it to go. And it has to do with a topic that we've discussed a lot on Tuesday Topics, and that topic is who's responsible for making things accessible for people who are blind. And that applies to websites, and it may apply to appliances, and it certainly applies to equipment. And it relates to, in particular, to a section of what used to be the Rehab Act, Section 508, that sets requirements for agencies of the federal government. And that's actually all that it does, though, as we'll see later, Section 508 has come to have applications considerably beyond just that. The folks who are responsible for writing regulations for Section 508, the Access Board, created an advisory committee to help them to make decisions about what direction they should go. And there are representatives on that advisory committee from a wide range of sources. And that committee last week published a very long report that relates to the whole question of accessibility to 508. And it is our pleasure this evening to have as our guest one of the members of that advisory committee, whose name is Brad Hodges and who works for the American Foundation for the Blind. And I think I'd like to begin by asking Brad, well, first welcoming to the program, but then asking Brad if he would tell us a little bit about who's on the committee, how much they meet, what they meet, and really perhaps a little bit more than I've said about their charge from the Access Board. So welcome, Brad, and off you go.
Well, good evening, Paul. Thank you so much for your kind invitation. But I guess at the top of the show, I've really got to tell you, I'm shocked to learn that anybody would think that Section 508 is boring. Why, in fact, I understand that there are plans for 508, the musical, to be launched on Broadway very, very soon, starring Elaine Stritch, I'm told, actually. Seriously, 508 is, at best, arcane business. And if you can imagine 42 organizations represented around some very large conference tables, ranging from organizations representing consumers, including the American Foundation for the Blind, the American Council of the Blind, the National Federation of the Blind, the Blinded Veterans of America, and others, a great number of industry representatives from small companies. Many of you will have never heard of any of these companies before, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, Sun, Dell, Panasonic, Avaya, seriously, very large and important companies in the federal scheme of things, since many of those companies are primary providers of technology to the federal government. The states were represented by virtue of the fact that in many of the states, Section 508 has an important role to play in how state technology is procured, And then finally, other stakeholders, and that's the new term now, stakeholder. That's not a person with a T-bone in their hand. That's somebody who's interested in something as a stakeholder. And other stakeholders included representatives from some of the federal agencies, the Social Security Administration, and the Department of Homeland Security, most notably, as well as some international participation, colleagues from the European Union, and from Japan, from Australia, and from the UK. That was the sort of the corpus of the group, 42 organizations. Each organization designated a representative and an alternate. The quorum for the meetings was 27. We had, I believe, 9 or maybe 10 face-to-face meetings in D.C. We always had a quorum there. We had many more teleconferences, and sometimes we would have a quorum. Often we would not. That presented challenges. So this was sort of like herding cats, as they say. And if you can imagine herding cats in person being one deal, herding them on the telephone is quite another. But we did work, I think, very effectively. We worked collaboratively, and ultimately we produced over an 18-month period of time, which someone observed as like being pregnant twice without a pause. Over 18 months, we did present, write and present a report last week in D.C.
Talk a little bit more about the charge of the advisory committee, if you would, Brad. Where does it fit into Section 508? And is it a one-time operation, or will you guys continue to exist and produce another report down the road?
No, Paul. Our charge has been completed. It was a one-time effort. The committee was called TITAC, or TTAC, T-E-I-T-A-C, and I was trying to reconstruct the acronym in my mind. It's Telecommunications and Information Technology Advisory Committee, I believe was the actual acronym, and we were constituted as a preliminary step to advise the Access Board as it begins to make the rules which will refresh Section 508. It's been a number of years since the last rule was implemented, and so this was the beginning step to provide to the Access Board the view from the stakeholders, from industry, from consumers, from government, from the states, from the international community on Section 508. And I should also add another interesting twist in this odyssey was including Section 255 of the Telecommunications Act, which some of you may recognize as the number that's commonly associated with the rules regarding accessibility of telecommunications devices and services. We were trying to harmonize to as much of an extent as we could some of the technical provisions so that a device which would have been accessible under 508 would be the same as a device which would be accessible under 255, etc. So with that dual mission in mind, we sort of have now kicked off what will be probably a two-year process, which will result in new rules, and those rules come from the Access Board.
So before we get into the nitty-gritty of the report itself, why not talk a little about the process? First, what was it? And second, how well did it work? And perhaps third, because I think it's kind of related, was it a good process for the blindness community?
Okay, make sure I keep on track with your subjects here. First, how did it work? We had, at the beginning of the process, an opportunity to choose what sort of report it would be. There were a couple of options, and I don't know that we were as clear in our minds as we might well have been. One option would be the option that I would call generality, and that would be to provide to the Access Board a number of fairly high-level observations based on an analysis of the current regulations and the current experience, where it's doing well, where it needed to be changed. The alternative which we selected was what I would call the alternative of specificity or granularity. The report is very, very, very detailed and very technically specific as contrasted with most regulatory advisement from what we understand. that was ultimately the path we chose for a whole host of reasons, which we can get into later on. The way it worked then was we went through the current regulations and we sort of parsed them all up and started working in a subcommittee process on the various areas. So telecommunications, web and content, sort of functional areas had subcommittees. And these committees would work and provide information to the general group at a meeting, and then we would try to reach consensus. It was a consensus-based process, and that's the cat herding I was talking about earlier. So we would have regulations that we would try to consensus over. And I remember many a meeting where you would literally argue about a single sentence for a half an hour. Maybe you would or maybe you wouldn't reach consensus on it. But consensus was a key. The board wanted a consensus-driven report. And so when and if you read the report, you will see that there's a great corpus of data, specifications and standards which are consensed, and then there are sort of outlying standards or suggested standards that didn't reach consensus, and you can look at the report and determine, you know, did they not receive consensus by a, you know, by a whisker? Was there a word or two that somebody disagreed with, or was it a really controversial idea? So that was how that worked. And you asked me a third point, and I'm sorry I've been wandering on here. Refresh me, please.
He assumes that I'll remember. I think the third question was you've sort of answered, and that is how did you actually arrive at decisions? And if it was consensus-driven, does that mean that a single person who said no thank you could derail a recommendation and essentially make it an outlier? And did that happen a lot? And, let me just ask that.
In true committee fashion, the answer is yes and no and yes and no. The meaning of consensus was itself a very frequent topic of discussion. It came to mean that, exactly as you said, in some cases. In other cases, it did not. And the report reflects this. There were provisions which, you know, had 26 in favor and one no, and then there were others that would have probably kind of been half and half. So generally it meant that, yeah, it was, can you live with this? So the chairman would ask on a particular item, is there anyone who can't live with this? And if there was silence, then it was considered consensed. That's how it worked.
Did the committee divide itself into sides? I mean, one would assume that you might have the consumers on one side and industry on another, but that may be too simplistic a way of describing the way that the committee functioned. So maybe you could talk a little bit about whether we did end up forming, I don't want to use the word clique, perhaps groups that tended to vote together?
Yes and no. On every issue, certainly you had people lined up in different camps, although we would switch off. An example of that would be a provision which had to do with an expectation that assistive technology, that's screen readers, screen magnifiers, primarily for us blind folks, would be required to do a certain number of things. One would expect, perhaps on the face of it, that consumers would not necessarily expect that would be in there. We would not support such a move. It turns out that we did. I was very vehement in expressing my notion that there is a role for assistive technology. Specifically, the proposal was that assistive technology would make use of interfaces that mainline technology provided to it. So, for example, MSAA in a web browser would be an example of that. So industry and consumers were bedfellows on that particular effort. Then there were some where you would imagine things to be as they turned out. There was one provision, 1.E or 1E, which very simply stated that any device that has a visual display would have an auditory way of using the device. Industry felt very strongly one way on it, consumers very strongly the other way on it. So therein, you know, was sort of the mix on that.
I think it's time that we got to discussing the report itself. maybe you could provide people with an overview of how the report is organized and perhaps some advice on how they might read it if they're having difficulty sleeping.
Well, let me tell you that the report is many hundreds of pages long, and it consists of many sections. And this was a major point of discussion. You're using the term organized. Yes, there is organization there. One of the things that is a great concern with the path of specificity that we chose is that the report is of its nature very complex and it's very detailed. There is a website, teitac.org, that's teitac.org, where you can go get the document online and look at it. You will find that there is an overview and a summary. Then there are some areas that have to do with functional performance criteria, and these are broad concepts and ideas. There's an area that has to do with technical specifications, and these are very detailed. And then there are sections that have to do with unconsensed information or unconsensed provisions, and these all include the provision and then narrative. I want to say that there was a group called the Editorial Working Group, and they did an unbelievable amount of work in real time during meetings and at other times, morning, noon, and night, updating us. We went through, I forget how many different versions of this report, and they are to be commended to the work they did to produce the final report.
So, if a person were to read the overview and the summary, would one actually get a fairly clear idea of what the I'm trying to find again the right word here, informational value of the report, or do a lot of the unconsensed items in fact get left out of that summary and overview?
I think what the summary and overview addresses, it addresses accurately and fairly. I believe the second notion is also true, Paul, that there is a lot of interesting information to be found in the unconsensed as well. I think there are some important things that aren't in the report and that we didn't get to by virtue of choosing that path of detail. One of the great dilemmas of the current regulation is its enforcement. These, remember, are requirements of federal agencies. And how federal agencies procure, which is the term for purchase, electronic and information technology, or E&IT, which is part of the alphabet soup. And the board can produce technical requirements, and those technical requirements speak to industry and technology, but the requirements speak to agencies and the federal procurement process. And that is governed by something called the FAR, which is what the Federal Acquisitions Rule, I believe. And so that is something that the board does not have control of. It can make recommendations. At the same time, with regard to those provisions of 255, a collaboration with the FCC is an appropriate and an important thing to keep in mind, because the FCC speaks to telecommunications in many instances, either in addition to or separately from the board. So we have sort of a number of balls in the air, of which 508 itself is one, and the rulings of the Access Board and their boundaries. So within that set of boundaries, which kind of exist within another larger universe, sits our report.
So let's take a look at the scorecard. And I guess I'm going to ask you, and obviously this is one person's opinion, but a person who represented the blindness community and consumers in a very real sense on this committee. Tell us some of the good things that are in this report and that we need to be pushing.
There's a lot of really good stuff in the report. First of all, I think the report reflects our current understanding of accessibility. Let me give you an example. Under the current rules, if you produce something on compact disk or floppy disk, it is treated differently in terms of its accessibility than the same document or the same computer code if you publish it on the web. Those barriers and those differences based on how you distribute something have been erased. I think that's a very important thing. We speak, I think, in a more comprehensive manner to how we expect technology to behave. We expect keyboards to be of a certain technical specification so that they can be used tactically. We expect screens to be able to be viewed by people with low vision. We expect the functionality of a program to be able to be revealed to a screen reader. These are many important concepts and many important provisions that have come about based on our current knowledge. Where we get tangled up sometimes is in sort of the twin sets of ideas from industry. And there are times when industry says, we want you to be very general. Don't tell us how to do it, just tell us what needs to happen. So there was, reflecting that idea, this section 1E, which simply said that you had to make things visual, available by non-visual means. The industry's response to that was, well, you can't test that. We have no way of knowing when we have accomplished that. Be more specific. Well, then we would be more specific, and we would hear, well, don't be so specific, we want to innovate. So back and forth we would go. And therein, I think, still is the work that has to be done. But the report itself and the technical specifications, I think, are very comprehensive. Where they've been consensed, I think they're good. I think it's kind of like a piece of Swiss cheese. There are still some holes that have to be filled in.
So the report has some good things. You certainly alluded to some of those that might be bad things, but let me give you an opportunity to tell us, what are the things about the report that perhaps don't please us as much?
I think what doesn't please us is what didn't get said. And that is, first of all, a basic notion that devices which are actually accessible actually be purchased. There are two ways to claiming accessibility. One way is to create a set of standards and for a device to comply in theory with all of those standards. The other way is for a device to demonstrate that it's accessible. And when we have a purely or merely standards-based approach, we run, I think, the very real risk that a bunch of lawyers could stand up and say, well, it meets this standard, and it meets this standard, and it meets this standard, we're done, and yet the device still doesn't work for people. The other thing I think that is really missing, again, is this whole business of the disparity among the agencies in how and how rigorously they implement the requirements under 508. You have agencies like the Social Security Administration who are doing outstanding work. They are testing, they are consistent, and they have truly provided accessibility. Then you have other agencies who don't even know what 508 is. And therein lies, I think, the big job ahead of us is to help, to the extent we can, to help the board figure out how to get the regulations implemented consistently and uniformly, whatever they are.
And we're going to open it up for people to raise specific questions or to make comments in just a little while. But I think before we do that, we ought to talk a little bit about the future. And let's begin by asking you to tell us what now happens to your report and what's the best you can expect that will happen, and perhaps what's the worst that you can expect will happen?
Worst case scenario, the board simply adopts the report as it is and converts that report into a rule. I don't think that's going to happen. Best case scenario is the report is a very important picture. I had the opportunity to present to the Access Board last Thursday. Seems like a lifetime ago. And I said in part that the report is a very detailed picture created with very fine pencils by many hands. We also have to think about the picture frame in which this detail picture is mounted and the larger wall on which the picture hangs, by way of metaphor, to suggest that there is work and detail and information outside the report which the board needs to consider. The board will digest the report over the summer. The staff will have a great deal of input in helping the board to discern the pertinent issues and to actually begin the process of writing the regulations. It's important to remember the board is made up of lay people like those of us on this system tonight. The board is not comprised of people from, you know, the IBMs and the Hewlett-Packards and the Sun Microsystems of the world. These are average citizens who spend a great deal of time and devote themselves to this effort. They are guided by staff and by those of us who will contact them, and I would encourage all of us to contact them as we move forward in this process throughout the summer, and I would expect into the fall they will actually begin to consider what form the regulations would take.
Which really does bring us to the next and perhaps the last question on our kind of two-person discussion, and that is, as a person who labored long and hard in this particular vineyard, what can we as a consumer community do to assure that the good stuff that's in this report actually does find its way into the regulations? Because I guess one of the concerns that I have, and I think there are others who share those concerns, is that you can write a report that says lots of wonderful things, but when the rubber hits the road, a lot of those wonderful things simply don't find their way into the regulations because the regulations are harder to write that way.
Precisely. The devil's in the details. Remember, decisions are made by those who show up. You know, that's an old saw that we've all heard for many years, but after being in these meetings week after week, on these teleconference calls week after week, that is so true. We have to show up. We have to show up individually, and we have to show up collectively through our consumer organizations. I hope and I trust that some effort, some coordinated effort, will survive this TITAC process through which we as consumers can represent our interests, our concerns to the Access Board, and call on the members of the Access Board to respond to these concerns that we have and dialogue with them in a real and a meaningful way as they progress. Remember, all of the people on the Access Board have disabilities. A number of them are blind and have vision loss. And I think it's reasonable to expect that we would be in contact with these people as our representatives and to really find out from them what they've got on their mind, what's going on, and help them construct an appropriate and meaningful rule.
From ACB Radio Mainstream, you are listening to Tuesday Topics. If you have comments about the show or a suggestion of a topic you would like to have discussed, send a message to TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. That's TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Once again, the host of Tuesday Topics, Paul Edwards.
Let me remind people and urge that you go out and take a look at this report at teitac.org, teitac.org. It is possible for you to download the report and read it at your leisure. And actually, though we've described it as something of a monstrosity and a little boring, there is a lot of really interesting stuff in this report, in my opinion, and certainly some ways of thinking about accessibility that hadn't occurred to me, and some accessibility issues that, frankly, because of my narrow focus on some of the visual issues, I hadn't considered enough. Even though I work with people with other disabilities, some of the issues that are a part of this report simply hadn't occurred to me. And it certainly creates, I think, if one reads it, a much broader perspective on all of the balls that the Access Board has to juggle in order to try to come up with a final report. So let me go ahead and open it up and see if people have some specific questions for Brad about the report or where we go from here. Remember, when you do speak, to tell us your name and to tell us where you're from.
Hello, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. Seems like, Brad, one thing that maybe ought to happen eventually, it seems like the cable companies ought to be held to 508 standards because I feel that for a blind person, I think that it's necessary for them to be able to use these cable boxes. But the problem is you can't see the screen to program something that you might want to record later. And seems like that ought to be one of the standards that ought to be set for that.
From our mouths to the cable company's ears, let's understand what 508 does and what 508 doesn't do. 508 cannot address the cable industry or the telephone company or anybody else. It addresses federal procurement. We were chatting about this the other day. I was chatting about it, in fact, with a blind member of the Access Board, and he said, you know, the VA has hospital rooms, and those are federal entities. And cable service or television service, it can come on a cable, it can come through a satellite, is E&IT. There's an interesting hook. That is how we have to think about these things. If we can get a hook in which the federal government is procuring this technology, then it affects the contract that the federal agency would have. If we think about the VA again for a moment, that would be the contract that the VA hospital would have with whoever is providing that television service. Now, if the house next to the VA hospital has the same television service, no guarantee that box that is accessible in the VA hospital would be available to the consumer at home. But the idea would be that it's more likely to be available since it's already being made available under the federal contract. That's how 508 is supposed to work.
Another question for Brad.
Hi, this is Brian from the Boston area. I'm really curious how they went about defining this, what was it, E&IT. How far does that extend in terms of things that I've seen in offices, like photocopiers, phone displays, these kinds of things, even a matter of the controls, the environmental controls in buildings and that kind of thing?
Brian, that's a great question. And this is, I think, a central issue with this whole notion of consistency among federal agencies. In some agencies, it goes very far. So you would have copiers that have accessibility. You would have computer systems that would have accessibility. Think about something like a BlackBerry. If you're a management-level federal employee and you join up on the federal service right now, you get a BlackBerry, you get a cell phone, and you get a laptop because they don't want you in the office every day. They want you telecommuting. As a blind person, getting access to the BlackBerry part of it is a real challenge, and that varies a lot. So it doesn't go far enough, and there is of course discussion as to how far it can or should go. An example of that was when we had a discussion about biometric identification. If you have a self-contained biometric identification, like on a security system in an office building, if that didn't connect to another technology, if that didn't connect to another piece of information technology, would it apply? Maybe, maybe not. If it works on a network, then it applies. So you have all of this parsing of the understanding, and the closer you get to the margins, you know, the things like the biometric indicators and the security apparatus of the federal government, which of course is omnipresent. The closer you get to those fringes, the tougher this stuff all gets, Brian.
Brad, I'm going to return for a moment to the issue that Gary raised and this whole issue of of indirectness, if you like. It seems to me that we as the blindness community are placed in kind of a difficult position in a way, in that we can't, given the regulations that we have, directly point at the people who are building the equipment badly, whether those are manufacturers or whether they're purveyors of entertainment. What we instead have to do is go after the people who are spending their money simply to buy the equipment. Do you see anything odd about this kind of role that we have to play?
No. Unfortunate, dysfunctional, regrettable, discriminatory even, certainly, but not odd. We live in a society and we have governmental notions of government which are increasingly less and less and less regulatory in nature. So this idea of, you know, kind of driving accessibility forward through these very remote control mechanisms, if you will, are not at all surprising. And I think HD radio, for example, is a perfect example. I think it would have been perfectly appropriate to say, as a condition of using the public airwaves for the purpose of a new radio service, the receiving equipment will not only meet the technical standards to receive the signal, but it will behave in a certain way that will allow all citizens whose airwaves these are, presumably, to use that equipment. But we don't live in that kind of a society. We don't have that kind of government. And so, do I view it as odd? Unfortunately, Paul, I don't view it as odd.
I'm going to glom on to HD radio as well, and only because this was one of those concepts that we, certainly in ACB, and I suspect that in other places in the blindness community as well, we tried to get on top of long before it came out. I know that in the middle to late 1980s, I was writing resolutions concerning HD radio, urging precisely what you just described. That is, that before we ever open that particular Pandora's box, we have lots of time to do the right thing. So let's do it. And the bottom line was, it was that approach was an absolute failure, which suggests to me that what you say is correct, and that we shouldn't really worry too much, because when we try to do the right thing, it really doesn't seem to work. I guess related to my question, I'm going to do this kind of for follow-up purposes, related to my question, what do you see as how forceful consumers ought to be? You alluded, for example, to federal agencies who have no notion of what Section 508 is. That's a pretty appalling state of the game. There are certainly agencies in states that have Section 508 as their rule who have no idea that Section 508 exists. So my question, I guess, is, do you believe that we can confront people on general principle, or do we have to find someone who is employed in these places or who is trying to use the services of these places who will be our poster child?
We need plaintiffs and not poster children, I fear. It is, with regard to Section 508 specifically, it is the latter, Paul, as many people in this seminar may know, or this presentation may know, there you have to have standing to bring an action or to bring a complaint with 508. I think that the public-facing part of this is primarily the web, and the federal agencies have done a quite a good job of making the web accessible. And I think those efforts did help illuminate the path for the private sector throughout, you know, like 2001 into 2005, let's say. I worked for the National Federation of the Blind at the time, and through a program of web accessibility encouragement that we were running, I did observe many, many websites changing their code and improving accessibility by virtue of the fact that federal sites had done it and it was viewed as possible and reasonable to do it. But as far as more practical, everyday sorts of nitty-gritty, things like the copiers and the phone systems and that sort of stuff. You've got to be a federal employee who is affected by this in order to bring a complaint or move an action forward.
Help me to understand why. And maybe this is not a fair question, and if it isn't, just tell me to stop it. Let us suppose that the federal government is, or a particular agency of the federal government is building a new building, and that building is going to eventually house employees. One of the barriers to employing people with disabilities, clearly, is that the employer doesn't want to spend the dollars that are required in order to make the workplace and the individual's job accessible. Or that's certainly what we hear. So would it not make more sense to infer that Section 508 actually is going to require, particularly with renovations or new constructions or new systems, that those new systems be accessible not for the sake of someone who is now employed, but for the sake of a person with a disability who potentially could be employed?
I think that's a calculus and a nuance that is far outside the scope of 508. Frankly, Paul, I think it's a reasonable and a reasoned analysis, but I don't think it really has much to do with the reality. The reality is that when you're talking about building a new building, the only thing in that building that would have reference to 508 would be E and IT, electronics and information technology. The rest of it, having to do with physical accessibility, etc., is found in other provisions, in other regulations, and in other law. Not being an attorney, I can't go into more specifics than that, but the boundaries of 508 are electronics and information technology. The people impacted by that, except for those relatively few public interactions, are federal employees, and they are the ones who must enforce that, unfortunately.
And you don't think anybody would buy the notion of potential federal employees, huh?
According to what I understand from the feds, that specifically can't be contemplated.
Hi, this is Sue Amateur from Washington State, and I wondered if you could repeat how we can access the report again. I missed that.
Sure, Sue. I should say, by the way, I'm in West Virginia tonight. Everybody's telling where they are, and I don't know that I mentioned where I am. You can go to the TEITAC.org website, and you can also go to the Access Board website, and there is a Section 508 refreshment link. Now, in the event that you do not find an easy-to-locate link to the document, feel free to drop me an email. That's bhodges, B-H-O-D-G-E-S, at afb.net. That's bhodges, B-H-O-D-G-E-S, at afb.net. And I'll let the staff know if folks are having a hard time finding a link for an intact copy of that.
And about how long is the report, Brad?
Golly, Sue, several hundred pages. I'm sorry, I can't tell you how many.
And I'm sorry, like I say, I came in a little late. Is there an executive summary available?
Absolutely, and that's where I would recommend that you start, would be the executive summary. You'll find portions of the report, they will be called provisions, where we reached consensus. They are covered, I think, very nicely in the executive summary. So the second part of the report that you would want to read in your copious report reading time would be the unconsensed provisions. I think in there you will find some interesting content and perhaps some of the nuance of the give and take which took place during the process.
Another question for Brad.
Brad, will any of this apply to those who are doing contract work for the federal government? An awful lot is being outsourced these days. Does this extend to them?
I think it's an enormous question. I believe that the board will increase the scope of the requirements, and also there are terms that you will hear: scope and compliance. Scope and levels of compliance are terms you will hear. We talked a lot about harmonization to try to have, especially where the web is concerned, to try to have the 508 requirements harmonize with W3C, Web 2.0, WCAG, all of these standard-setting entities, regulations. But scope and compliance levels is the big thing. So you can say that things apply, but if they only have to apply some of the time or in certain places and not all of the time in all of the places, it doesn't really help to say they have to comply. And this whole notion of contractors, I think, sort of fits into that bundle of sort of the reach, if you will, of the requirements. And I think that's an important message to take to the board, that these expectations, these requirements, and these standards apply to contractors. Because as you say, with the privatization of everything, it clearly needs to reach to those entities as well.
There's a fascinating situation that, as an example, we might put on the board for folks. One of the things that ACB has been working on over the past couple of years is someone who has contracted with the Internal Revenue Service to provide what amount to kind of claim rep people who would work from home and who would be disabled. And that contractor has been less than forthcoming about making sure that the approach that they are taking in fact assures that people who are blind can perform that job. So it would be immensely helpful to see Section 508 very clearly and unequivocally point a finger at these guys and saying to, say, IRS, which is really in this whole process one of the good guys, not only do you have to do the good job that you're doing internally, but you also have to police your contractors and make sure that the stuff they do is okay, too.
Absolutely, Paul. The other interesting, probably the other side of that same coin, or another side of that same coin, it's a coin with a number of sides, is this free tax filing. We all, you know, can go off to IRS.gov and be able to go to a number of private websites from outfits like H&R Block and Intuit, etc., and file taxes and do so at no cost. And since a lot of blind folks are low income, that's a great thing until you run into the levels of accessibility or inaccessibility of these sites. The IRS has a contract with these people. The IRS is endorsing them. The IRS is pointing to them. But lo and behold, they don't really have to do anything in terms of accessibility, and you're stuck.
The IRS is the part of the federal government. Shouldn't they comply as well?
In my mind, they should, but as I understand the law right now, they absolutely do not have to.
And this is Sue again, and that again is because the entities are under contract. They're not the IRS itself, correct?
Sue, that's what the lawyers tell me. Yes, indeed. And there's a whole bunch of sort of waffling and wiggling that goes on. The IRS will say, well, golly gee, we just sort of point people over there to these outfits and we'll accept their data, and, you know, it's not really anything official. And then, of course, you have the whole idea that there's this very concerted effort to get people to file online because it's, you know, reduces the cost of handling all the paper in Kansas City or wherever you send your paper forms to. And so, you know, it's kind of a quagmire.
One of the things that we talked about earlier when we looked at the composition of the committee was the fact that some states were invited to participate. First, can you describe a little bit for folks who may not understand how Section 508 has come to involve states? And second, can you tell us what the participation of states was like? How did they seem to fit into that whole process?
The states were represented primarily by Diane Golden from the state of Missouri, who is representative who represented NASIO, the National Association of State Chief Information Officers. Their take on things was, I think, probably the most unique in the group. They are very, very concerned that the more complex and the more detailed the requirements become, that the less able the states will be to follow them. that if, you know, if we think that there is little compliance and a relatively low level of capacity in the federal agencies, that's nothing compared to what the poor states are going through. Most of the states, through legislation or executive orders, have some type of requirement for accessibility in purchasing of electronic and information technology. Now, in some state agencies or in some states, these requirements go much further, but most of them are either in part or totally based on Section 508. And so that was the genesis of the involvement of the states in this go-around of the rulemaking.
Brad, in your analysis, could you maybe give us an example of a couple of states that do have good 508 legislation that we might take a look at?
I can't say which would be considered good. I think if I were you, I would turn to your affiliates and experience. I am certainly not in a position to make any commentary there. The process of the TITAC didn't really reveal any detail about the processes and the laws and the executive orders in the states that I could draw from. I'm sorry.
I have a couple of questions. One is, in the word procurement, if a federal agency hires a contractor to come rework a piece of software used by an agency, how substantial does the change have to be before these regulations or actions have to take place? And in terms of remodeling the buildings, does the same thing apply in terms of definition of substantial when it comes to things like reworking software?
That's a great question. My understanding is that there is a threshold. I do not know what that threshold is or the circumstances. If that is something that is of interest to you, there is a woman by the name of Terry Weaver who works for the GSA, General Services Administration, and I would think you could find her fairly easily through a web search or even calling the Access Board. And if that question is of interest to you, I think Terry would be in a position to answer it straight away for you.
Thank you. I said I was going to ask two questions. My other question has to do with the length of time between the last time this process was gone through and this time. What would you say were, say, a couple of the most outstanding changes in technology out there that the old way of doing things missed as times and circumstances changed that you guys had to pick up on this time around?
That's a wonderful question. You're really making me think here, and I think it's probably one of the central questions. I think what has happened is the sort of the amalgam of information sort of flowing at us through kind of a big pipeline. I think when the original regulations were conceived of, the flow of information was through fairly identifiable and rather different pipelines. You had information that would come on a compact disc. You would have information that you would get on the web. You would have information that you would get through other ways. They were very distinct, and nobody really thought that they would kind of all wind up being the same. Now everything comes at you through the web, more or less. And I think that is one of the big changes. Also, the fact that we can now create more accessible documents. We have the means, we have the knowledge, we just need to have the will to make the documents accessible from the beginning of their life, rather than trying to patch them up after they're ready to be published.
One of the characteristics of a lot of federal websites is that there are a broad range of document types that seem to find their way there. And when you ask the people who put those sites together why that is, they say, oh, well, a lot of that is for those disabled people who need, quote, accessible documents. Was there any discussion about creating a standard that would, for instance, assure that PDFs were properly produced so that there wouldn't be a plethora of document types on federal sites?
Yes, there is a provision that all, and I believe the wording we we finally settled on was official communications, not to include, for instance, draft copies that might circulate among a small group of people in an office, but any official documentation. One of the huge areas is legacy documents, Paul, and that is often where we have separate document types for the same document. It is technically more expedient and often more useful to have an HTML or a text copy of a problematic PDF document than to spend the time and effort to make it kind of sort of accessible. But yes, there is the requirement that official communications will be accessible. That was a very clear statement.
As a person who lived through that 18 months of weekly agony, and I suspect that it often was very much that, you have travailed and given birth to a document, and now the question is, where does it go from here?
We've got to show up. You better believe that industry is going to show up. We've got to reach the members of the Access Board individually and collectively, meaning contact with any of the Access Board members we know. And, you know, a number of us probably do know a few of the folks on the board, if not all of them. Many of them represent disabilities and other than blindness, and we may or may not be active in those communities, but we certainly might know the folks who are blind. And I suspect, since this is very clearly often focused on blindness, those folks will provide leadership to their colleagues on the board. I would hope they would. I hope the colleagues would seek that leadership and heed it, just as other issues and other disabilities would be respected by those members of the board that represent those constituencies. I would encourage our organizations to collaborate. This is something, I think, where we have a great deal of commonality, common purpose. We have to recognize, though, that there are times when we have to really gear up and learn these regulations. So I think the first step is to read the report, get to know it. I think the next step would be at the convention time of the consumer organizations to begin a dialogue and a discussion and hopefully create some kind of a mutual plan to move forward. I think the timing is very good. It's a late summer, early fall sort of kickoff, I think, and that's in our favor.
I think you've made a very complex process pretty easily understandable by some of us who are not as savvy in the ways of the federal government. We very much appreciate both your candor and your involvement tonight. I want to thank everyone for listening. Remind people that if you have issues or questions, get in touch with me at TuesdayTopics@acbradio.org. Remember, you can find this report at teitac.org. This is Paul Edwards, host of Tuesday Topics, saying thank you so much for listening. And remember, just how much we're able to do will depend on how much we as consumers are prepared to do.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday at 1 hour Universal. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. That's ourplace.acbradio.org. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each program begins, those who are online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room software. An announcement about the show, including information about the topic and the guest speaker, will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends List. So we hope you will come and join us each week on Tuesday, when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. We'll look for you in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. Tuesday Topics is a production of ACB Radio Mainstream.